turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces.
Fingerford and surroundings, and of course the Chaos Camp and all our internet listeners. This is the Activist Hour. My name is Walter, and we have a wonderful bunch of guests. Brita Jonsdottir, MP from Iceland. Samara McCarthy, also from Iceland, founder of IMI, and I'll let you introduce it later on a bit. And on my right-hand side, there's Constanze Kutsch, CCC board member used to be?
Actually, spokesperson.
Spokesperson even. Sorry for not being that up to date there. And Thomas is also still around. GMC is doing the sound and may also interrupt us here and there. And there are also some other interesting people sitting in the studio, but probably remaining silent. Oh, Steph is immediately stepping out. And first, we'll start with a sound fragment from my favorite Republican president. And listen carefully.
Good judgment seeks balance in progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
So that was the part of the farewell address of President Eisenhower. It's late 40s, actually. And the question I'd like to kick off with our guest is, to what extent can we transpose this to the current situation? And let's start with Constanze.
Well, I guess it will... Well, I see some parallels to the cyber war discussion that we have. At least we have some in the first world. And in Germany, we have a somewhat cyber defense system with eight technical persons who try to defend the country from what is known as a shiny threat or something. But actually, you will be not surprised that I oppose that military terms to our civil net, and I don't like the rhetoric behind it.
Well, I don't like lots of rhetorics, but what about the substance?
Well, I guess most of the attacks that you can read about in the media which goes against government net and stuff like that. They say these are Chinese threats, but of course we don't have any proof for that. And so they built their enemy. And I guess what's behind it is just the industrial military complex trying to sell the new kind of weapons and try to militarize our civil nets. And of course we have to oppose that.
Well, and Smari, what are your thoughts?
Well, what I've noticed is that there's this strange tendency to think of the cyber warfare elements that seem to be emerging as if they're somehow different from what we've been seeing in terms of attacks on the internet over the last couple of decades. This is a bit weird because there's been no structural changes, and in fact, the internet itself hasn't changed structurally. But over kind of the last decade, we've seen a massive industrialization of the internet, and so militarization is kind of to be expected as well. But it's kind of odd. I was reading recently this this thing. I couldn't find it now, but it was saying that the scriptwriters who helped Eisenhower prepare that particular speech originally had intended to put the term military surveillance industrial complex, but then they dropped the term surveillance out so as not to piss off the CIA and these surveillance organizations, because they kind of knew that they could push it so far but not all that much further. And that kind of, you know, might be part of the issue here, that we are allowing, as Constance says, this kind of rhetoric to conjure up a new enemy without there actually being any evidence of there being an enemy, and the military surveillance industrial complex is just raking in the money, which is great. It's
somewhat ironic that Eisenhower actually addressed Chinese in the 40s, and that the Chinese are addressed again for being the enemy. It's kind of ironic.
Yeah, and in the Eisenhower years, the Soviets were the biggest threat, obviously.
Well, actually, they had bigger weapons. What they meant were nuclear weapons, actually, yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the Chinese didn't get any nuclear weapons until 1956.
No,
I
but
think.
They
yeah.
That was a threat.
On the
they
other
really,
hand,
they really had the threat to throw nuclear bomb to the Manchurian. I don't know the English word for Manchurian.
Manchuria, yeah.
Manchuria.
Yeah. But on the other hand, the US has still detonated more than half of the 2,053 nuclear bombs that have been detonated on the planet. So, you know, look to the cause. I'd say,
yeah, well, it's probably an unsafe subject to discuss nuclear armament. I may end up in the opposite direction as some of the others at the table. But we haven't asked Brigitte yet. Brigitte, sorry.
Okay, so I find this to be both disturbing and, in a sense, since I was sitting in a very interesting meeting at the NATO Parliamentary Assembly in my committee, there was this report, or a draft report introduced on the last meeting by Lord Shopling from the United Kingdom. And it's about information and national security, and I really encourage all of you to read it if you haven't done so yet. And there they go through, you know, the cable gate, the digital hackivism, lacking the K in it, Anonymous and various others, and at the same time they're trying to create some sort of or their argument was the attack on Estonia, and they had a guy from there explaining, you know, how scared they got actually and what they're trying to do to counterbalance that sort of attack. It's never been defined from where this attack came, which I find to be quite interesting. And
but
I feel
the Russians are the one who
the obvious, but it's never been, you know, directly
defined.
There's
also a Russian minority in Estonia, which could easily be the cause of this.
But at the same time, that attack has created a lot of leverage with politicians to allow for further development of this concept of, you know, warfare, you know, in our world, on the online world. It's just, you know, as a part of this, like Smauri said, you know, it's a part of the industrialization of the internet, and it is a part of how the powers in the offline world are trying to steal our world and to make it into the offline world. And that was the beauty of the internet in the early days, is that we were creating a world without borders, where people could have a flow of information without any sort of, you know, both surveillance and blockage. And I think that we should battle this in all ways possible. And thus I encourage everybody. I have to go back to my NATO Parliamentary Assembly meeting with amendments to this particular report. So I encourage people to read it, and if they see anything in it that they want to be fixed, I will try to include it in my counter report.
Stick it on an etherpad.
Allow
people to hack on it and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, is this a report that suggests that a cyber attack, I hate the term by the way, can be countered by a physical attack?
Yeah, that was the really interesting conclusion after this meeting, was that I asked some questions, and obviously they didn't want to, since I'm in this particular committee, they didn't want to have my voice when they were making the draft, because I'm associated with WikiLeaks in the early days, or in the middle days.
The heydays.
So I asked some tough questions, and one of the questions was, when they were talking about this definition of, cyber war and counterattack with real military stuff, the offline military warfare, they said, oh, it's a secret. When we define when it is a real attack that justifies real war, because the others that might be using the internet for cyber war will push the boundaries all the way to where we define it. But this has to be stopped, because this is very dangerous, and it just is obviously so stupid. And it's obvious that the people writing these reports, they don't know anything about the internet, and that is very disturbing.
They talk about Stuxnet. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, I just wanted to know if they have something about Stuxnet in there. Have they discussed that?
No, they didn't discuss it.
We'll get back to Stuxnet slightly later on. I was more thinking about the possibility of India outsourcing its war with Pakistan to the United States by simulating a cyber attack again.
Yeah.
Wonderful terminology. On the United States, for example, or a NATO partner. Mm-hmm.
So there's this thing. There was a great article on Reason.com just a couple of days ago about, they called it the cybersecurity industrial complex. Jerry Brito and Tate Watkins wrote it. And it was a great article, but there was one kind of sentence that just really kind of hit me as like, oh shit, these people are really missing the point, which was, it said, a re-engineered, more secure internet is likely to be a very different internet than the open, innovative network we know today. A government that controls information flows is a government that will attack anonymity and constrict free speech. So these are two sentences, and individually they're both absolutely true. But the implication that's kind of hidden in them is that that the only way to make a more secure internet is to allow governments to control it. And that's absolutely not true. The hacker culture has been saying for years, or certain fragments of it at least, that security online is a kind of all or nothing venture, in the sense that if you... even if one country could make the impenetrable fortress of super security, then that country would still be subject to DOS attacks from the rest of the world. There's actually, NATO has a wonderful term for denial of service attacks. They call it iWAR, as if it's an Apple product or something. But
I'd like to see Steve Jobs present. and now for something slightly different than all that. There's also a certain irony, in given that Reason.com is a mostly libertarian-leaning web magazine, and they're asking for the government to step in and make the internet a safer place.
Yeah, well, so the thing
for
is...
For the children.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But I mean, what we can do is make the internet safer from governments who wish to play their little cyber war games by implementing proper security measures. One of the easiest things to do, it's practically difficult because there's a lot of push against it, and there's a lot of infrastructural difficulty, but implementing IPv6 will bring in IPsec, which will greatly, just as one step, increase the overall security of the internet. Then, encouraging things like HTTPS everywhere, Tor, etc., will just raise the barrier more and more, so that cyber warfare just becomes harder to accomplish.
I'm not entirely convinced about, but I like the notion of restore the stolen innocence of the internet. And in that vein, I'd like to play some music. It's called Pixel My Heart by Lukasz. Back to the subject of cyber warfare. This was, by the way, Pixel My Heart by Lukasz, and from their album Digital Memories. You can find it on the internet. Download it and enjoy. Anyway, back to the subject of cyber warfare. Stuxnet came along, obviously, hard to avoid. And I thought, yes, this was one of those defining moments when I read the first articles about that. And I thought, well, I'm actually... you always do, but that was kind of the moment. Well, this is a historical moment. This is the first time. This is the kind of bit like when the first airplane sunk a battleship. It's the end of an era and the beginning of a new one. This kind of experience. On the other hand, there's a certain irony in there, because by using this weapon, whoever was behind that, it also put it in the hands of their potential adversaries. Because it has been reverse engineered extensively already. There are copies of Stuxnet floating around. There's lots of analysis. It's interesting that the fact, I think in that sense, cyber warfare indeed is different from offline warfare. Normally when you drop a bomb on someone's head, you don't provide them with the blueprints. And now they have. That's, well, Constance is agreeing with me. That's, we can't have that in the discussion. But go ahead.
Well, yes, I agree. Versus that is a weapon. I would say it is a weapon. But you are, of course, right. The fact that you could get a hold of it, reverse engineer it, makes really a difference. And of course, for the question for how to defend it, but also for the question who actually made it, and how many hours did it take, and how many men, and how many money? That is really interesting to have maybe an idea who was it. And it's totally clear that it's really a lot of people with a lot of technical knowledge and a lot of money. And that makes it, oh, for God's sake, quite unique weapon. So we won't see any Stuxnet every month. That is totally clear. But it's, of course, not the last Stuxnet.
Well, I would say yes. The analysis, the commonly held analysis, is that it's not so much the amount of code, but the knowledge, the different areas of knowledge. So the domain knowledge needed to do this was probably not in reach of many nation states, and that kind of narrows it pretty much down. And I don't think that it will not be repeated. It's quite often, this is kind of also a proof of concept.
Of course it can be repeated, but it's not a cyber weapon which we will see every 2 months.
Yeah, well, so Stuxnet actually used 3 different zero-day exploits. Which,
four.
So, okay, I knew about 3 of them. So that in itself is pretty unique, and even more so if it's 4, because zero-day exploits are closely guarded, of course. You know, people don't play with them.
There are lots of people playing.
What I mean is when you have an exploit like that, you use it carefully. If you're going to do something malicious, you make sure that it has maximum impact. Putting 4 eggs in a very big basket is, you know, almost unheard of in that sense. And that alone suggests that there were some very big players behind it.
It was actually the opposite. It was putting eggs in 4 different baskets. Yes,
you're dissecting the analogy.
Yes,
but I have to acknowledge that I was wrong. They didn't talk about it, but it's in the report, and it's very interesting how the NATO people define this, because they call Stuxnet as described as a cyber weapon of mass destruction. Of particular note is that the vast majority of complicated information technology systems that are potentially vulnerable to Stuxnet are located in NATO. And NATO partner countries.
That's a wonderful way of describing it, because I would expect them to consider this a surgical strike with no collateral damage whatsoever. Mm-hmm. This is the.
Well, but they consider it a weapon of mass destruction. That's unbelievable lingo. You know, it's.
Yeah, that's like only the military could define something like that. I heard about the term preemptive strike. For Stuxnet too, but weapon of mass destruction is even better, because we can think of Powell and then Iraq weapons of mass destruction.
I felt so cheated. No, I'm not making this up. I respected Powell deeply, but apparently he has been cheated in the process as well. But no, you're
was
making
cheated?
A very nasty face at me.
Oh, well, my trust in Powell was maybe not that big as yours.
Yeah, okay, maybe I'm an idiot for trusting him to begin with. No, I'm serious. I tend to trust generals when they talk about war, and not...
Seriously?
Seriously, I mean, George W. Bush was a draft dodger. He never was in Vietnam. Powell was in Vietnam. One of the reasons, Eisenhower is my favorite Republican president. He was a president. He wasn't a general. He came from a military family. He is the kind of person who would not go into military action lightly, because he had seen the implications of war very much firsthand.
Yeah, that is true. People who have military experience or experience from war zones are much their approach towards warfare is much more reasonable and sane most of the time.
Most of the time.
Yeah. As always, not always, but yeah. But most, and that was one of the reasons at that time I thought, well, maybe there is a threat. It just didn't feel quite right. But I have to admit, around the time Iraq came along, I was a kind of a reluctant supporter of that war, and that war is turned out to be complete fabrication. That's,
did you believe it, the stuff that was told in advance?
Well, I actually saw the presentation by Powell in
front of the United Nations. It was live on the internet.
It was live on CNN, and I was without a job at the time, and I was watching CNN all the time. And that was, and Cartoon Network, I have to admit.
What about Fox?
Fox is not available in the Netherlands for a very bad reason, actually.
Really?
No, there is a kind of an overly social democratic influence on programming. And I think, well, let people experience Fox firsthand and allow them to make it. Well, we're kind of digressing from the Stuxnet discussion. I wanted to throw in.
You started that.
I'm sorry for that. And I wanted to throw in a very lawyer-like question, but which was another one which popped up in my mind when Stuxnet came along. Siemens, the wonderful German industrial conglomerate, told its clients, despite knowing that Stuxnet went around, not to change the default passwords everybody was being used, because the software was likely to stop functioning if you change the default passwords. And my first thought was, if you're so, I would say, no, not cheap. It was more about being willfully stupid, ignorant about the security of your products. Shouldn't we have product liability for this?
Well, it's a kind of old discussion. We have that every, I don't know, four years, questioning about how is really responsible, who have to pay maybe for certain things that happen because of your ignorance or stuff. And I guess it would be a good way, but I guess it's about money too. Well, IT security is always about money in terms of how many people and how much of your investment in a company you throw on that.
Well, I would say that the fear of lawsuits, but I'm a lawyer by training.
Oh, you didn't tell us that before.
Yes, Constanze is making even more nasty faces by the second. Yes, at some point in time, she will just run away from me. No, the reason
that... Well, we have a lawyer, which is an Eisenhower fan and a power trustee.
Yeah.
And somebody who obviously didn't read Frank Crevel's leak. Back in February of 2004, just before they invaded, where he basically gave proof that the entire thing was a fabrication. And I'm pretty sure Powell read that one too.
You know? I thought that... We'll get back to the later. The point I was going to make is... I, to make it even worse for Constanze, I consider myself a liberal ideologically. Yes, so... and now I've made it completely... I consider the fear of lawsuits to be a more effective way to make the internet a more resilient infrastructure than merely saying the government should make the internet more resilient.
Oh, but you're preaching security through policy instead of security through design then.
I'm a favor of people giving an incentive to design stuff properly.
Okay, fair enough, but...
Unsafe at any speed? Anyone?
Okay, but then I have to throw in one question, and that has to do with cybersecurity for the civilians in cyberspace, because we don't have much rights, the people who have their information online. And, for example, it really depends on jurisdictions. Most of the content is hosted in the US, of the social media content. Then we really don't know where all the medical history records are kept, or your medical records.
Passenger name records.
Passenger name records is wonderful. Yeah.
And at the same time, we are only referred to as users and consumers online. And I think this is a very huge issue when it comes to our cybersecurity. And it is very important to address it, but I would be very curious to see how people or hear what you guys think about how it should be tackled.
Nowadays, professionally, I do IT law. I advise my clients not to do business with American companies to begin with. Ever since Microsoft was so honest to say, well, even although our data center is in Ireland, if under the Patriot Act, the US government comes along and asks data, we will provide them. And Google, I think we should applaud Microsoft for being honest about that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to blame them for this policy position, where if I were in their shoes, I would take the same policy decision, quite likely.
They're between a rock and a hard place in that one, because it is law in their country.
So Google did the same two days ago. They had basically the same saying, that they are under the Patriot Act and that they...
Shouldn't they move their companies out of the United States then, not only the servers?
Well, actually, it's an American company, so I don't wonder.
No, but seriously, I mean, there are so many people using the internet and using their services that don't want to be having their information shared the way they share it. So, I mean, either we, the users, should leave these companies, or they will leave the United States, because there are many, many more people using the internet and their services than there are in the United States.
But that is precisely my point. If you do business and do stuff with cloud computing, etc., and you don't want to be the subject of several jurisdictions at once. I mean, recently, especially with the Irish mesh, if you have your stuff with Amazon or Microsoft in Ireland, they have massive data centers over there. For especially when it comes to personal data, let's assume my client is a Dutch company who's using Amazon in Ireland. Because of the way the Data Protection Directive works, the Dutch implementation of the Data Protection Directive applies to this personal data. Then Irish law is also applicable, because it's physically in an Irish jurisdiction. And then it's with an American company, which by the Patriot Act, then the Americans say, well, it's under our jurisdiction.
What? For me, the approach to, or a kind of a solution for that problem is, of course, to get hold of your own data. I may remind you, on services like OwnCloud, you don't have to put your data to that commercial.
But we
companies.
Are also agreeing that, well, my personal response, and that's not a is peer-to-peer everything.
Yeah.
And there are interesting advances being made in cryptography nowadays, that even you can have processors which can process data, which is be encrypted at the time. Doesn't have to be decrypted to have algorithms applied to that data, and that's a very interesting approach. But again, we're digressing very much.
What about the general public? Because most people, you know, that listen to this radio station all agree. But, you know, this is a minority compared to all the other people.
This is interesting, because lots of people from the general public start asking questions about this. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the very positive things, I think, about the cloud computing phenomenon. There are lots of questions being asked about cloud computing, which should have been asked 10 or 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, those questions become more and more acute, but they're not new in the sense.
No.
Not at all. Yes, I'm becoming an old fart. Yeah. I am one. And,
nobody disagrees with you, don't
No. I was. Shut up, smart. Well, I'd like to get back to the Mars Surveillance thing, but then after one of my favorite songs by Sputnik Booster, from his album Robot Science, and the title is in there.
I don't hear it playing.
It's a silent song.
That's not silent.
Oh, a silent song,
yeah.
John Cage?
Innovative.
I thought you only played CC stuff.
That's not John Cage.
There's no music there, Walter.
So maybe this is kind of fake.
John Cage is not under Creative Commons license. This is really bad.
Right. Maybe it's a license question.
Mm. Oh, there we go. Deutschland.
We'll be right back.
Well, that was the epic song Deutschland muss sterben, and it is a slime cover by Sputnik Booster. And, well, I quite like it, but that must be because I'm Dutch, so I apologize to our German listeners. back to slightly more serious subject, though. Smari said, asked a very relevant question, sorry for slurring a bit here. What is national security, and how should we define that? Thomas, do you have any thoughts on that?
I just said earlier that I totally think this discussion is so balanced and very funny and interesting, so I do not really want to interrupt, and also I have no answer for this question.
That's more to the point. Thank you.
Well, okay, so the kind of draft definition that I've been trying to work on is basically when people talk about national security, they're talking about two very different things, only one of these two things. On the one hand, the security of the people living within a state, and on the other hand, the security of the state as an institution. And in a kind of perfect state, these would overlap perfectly and be one and the same. But unfortunately, societies are not perfect, and governments in particular are getting increasingly bad. So they're kind of drifting apart. And in many cases, like Syria now, for example, are entirely disjoint from one another. So if we separate these two out, then the question of what is national security becomes so much easier to deal with.
Well, given that in a democratic state, the structure of the state already encompasses processes for changing those structures. There is, to speak in IT terms, change management procedures in there, also known as elections.
Oh, yeah, we've seen how they go.
I don't know actually if the term national security in some way applies on the internet. I can't even imagine if national is a good category.
No, but the NATO report that's been quoted a couple of times here is talking about cybersecurity as a thing that has to be thought into for the protection of national security.
Well, NATO, that's kind of an anachronistic organization, right? So.
Well, states tend to be, but
I think by definition states are anachronistic.
Yes.
And so are laws.
So I don't know if it really fits to the virtual open space.
It doesn't. But I mean,
I don't believe so much in the distinction between the virtual, the open, the online, and the offline. I think both the idea of John Perry Barlow about this manifesto of cyberspace and politicians keep out of our wonderful paradise, kindergarten, whatever you call it. And the notion which is behind a lot of legislation is that what offline applies should apply online equally are both bollocks.
Well, but you know that John Perry Barlow really distinguishes himself from his own Declaration of Independence, right?
Well, that's great to see a hippie grow up here and there.
One of the things there is just at what point do you enforce the regulation? At which point do you kind of put limitations on free speech? Are you going to do it at the origin of the transmission or the end point?
Well, the idea of free speech has always been that you do not do... you won't have any prior checks on free speech.
Yes, of course.
If it turns out to be harmful, generally speaking, you do that afterwards. And there's also this brilliant quote from from Justice Brandeis of the U.S. Supreme Court: "Free speech doesn't extend to yelling fire in a crowded theater."
Oh yeah, well, sure, but that's kind of
free speech. But
there's always a but. And also, although everything after the butt is bullshit, but there's no such thing as...
No, I mean, this entire idea of free speech has kind of become somewhat obsolete because we are on the internet, and there it isn't about speech in the classical sense of the word, but more about how
free
information...
Typing.
Yeah, well,
freedom of expression, notion.
No, how does information behave? Because, I mean, there's just a very limited set of things that you can do fundamentally with information. You can transmit it, you can receive it, you can store it, you can,
consume it.
I'm not sure about that, but.
Information also can be artifacts like code, and code transforms other data, information. It it's also affecting the real world, and that's why I consider the notion, and I'm glad that John Perry Barlow came to the census, and I highly respect him, by the way. Mm-hmm. So you can put him in the same list as Eisenhower, Powell, yeah. John Perry Barlow.
Okay,
in my
I will
books.
Keep that in mind.
Yes. You know but I think at the same time, it's very important at this time and age where we're living through times of extreme quickening, where everything's happening very quickly because we are so interconnected, that we go into places of power as well as they're not only knocking on the doors outside. I've been on both sides. And I never aspired to be a politician. I just helped create sort of a coalition of all the different grassroots groups in order to achieve some democratic reform. And we actually put in our agenda that we can't exist more than 8 years max and have to dissolve. And I think that is very important. And we don't have any leaders. We have a horizontal structure. And I think the most important thing that we need to change the way we see laws, because they're so alien to most of us and they're written in an alien language. So let's look at it as we're looking at the system mainframe in the offline world, and we want to hack into this system. That's the laws, and we want to find the weaknesses and want to find the flaws and want to improve the flaws for the benefit of everybody, not the lobbyists. And we need to start to rewrite the laws and be prepared for the next crisis. So the shock doctrine is not only for the benefit of those that have the largest lobbyist groups. And I really, really think it's important that people start to look at laws this way. Instead of, you know, as something unapproachable. And usually, you know, like it was very interesting to listen to one of the ministers from Holland at the Freedom of Press Day. And he was basically talking about laws are like sausage and you don't want to know what's in it. We want freedom of information to know what's in that bloody sausage, because that's the biggest danger is in our societies is this perfect marriage between the corporate and the state. And in order to unravel that marriage, we want a perfect divorce between these two things. We have to know what's in the sausage, and we want to put our voice in the sausage.
Of course.
Yeah, well, there's complete agreement there, so I'm going to throw in some music. And this ties in nicely with your subject of divorce. I only care about you when you're gone, by Leslie Hunt.
Very known for being very punctual. All of my friends know better than to show up right on time. I wanna be what you wait for, what you wait for before going on with your night. You know. So I do.
From the music. This was Leslie Hunt from her album Your Hair is on Fire, and the song is I Only Care About You When You're Gone. It's a deeply romantic song, obviously. I'd like to spend the last 8 minutes of this show, 7 minutes actually, on another question. We've been talking about mass destruction and actually also implicitly about mass surveillance. And to what extent is the debate about mass surveillance not just obsolete, given the explosive growth of sensors in our lives, and shouldn't be more talking about mass surveillance? Brigitta?
Yeah, absolutely. We should be talking about that.
That's a useless answer.
Okay, so
no, but the thing is, like, you know, just outside the Icelandic parliament, there are, I don't know how many monitors to monitor people that are just, you know, usually it is aimed at the people protesting.
Isn't it usually too cold in front of the parliament?
Too
protest?
Cold. No.
We
light fires.
Okay.
But we also like firecrackers, fireworks, yes. And the burning Christmas tree.
I made the mistake of taking a cycle on a vacation in Iceland in late September.
Oh, yeah.
But we'll talk about it after that.
So,
yeah, that was certainly a mistake. I usually feel very sorry for the people that do that. Yes.
So with regard to the kind of surveillance society we're in, somebody pointed out to me earlier, Eleanor Seta, that... The 9/11 memorial that's been raised, and, you know, kind of in 10 years since that happened, every single, like, you cannot stand anywhere in its vicinity without being covered by a CCTV camera. And, you know, just thinking about that in a historical context of, you know, where we came from and where we are now, that is just a deeply troubling thing. Yeah. Because somehow we've absolutely lost control of that narrative of to which degree we allow interference with our privacy.
Yeah,
in the public spaces, and I think we have to keep in mind the technology that is evolving now, and that means biometric terms, in terms of how can you maybe see in an automatic way the faces. Mm-hmm. But it's, for my opinion, not only about CCTV, it's more about the computers we have in our pockets.
Exactly, and they have actually just by default put this into Facebook, the face recognition thingy, and you have to know about it in order to turn it off. So there's so much extra stuff added to social media, and most people have not a clue about what's there. And it has to do with so many more things than just surveillance.
Well, yeah, the reason I ask about surveillance is that Cablegate, to a certain extent, is an example of surveillance, and as in the state being monitored by its citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And I found David Brin's book about the transparent society very fascinating.
Oh yes.
Constance is about the problem.
Oh, yeah. We will have a really big utopia with all being created equal, but we have all the transparent information, including private stuff. Oh, really?
Let's not forget Brave New World.
Finding a book fascinating
just
is
everybody
the same as believing
Brave
it,
New
okay?
World again.
It sounded like that, Mr. Lawyer.
The snark.
I mean, you should really read that book to see how the future should not be like.
Well, dystopian novels are much more interesting than utopian novels.
Yeah, I know. I like, I like maybe utopian and dystopian, right? Okay. So we are at least in the end. We have consensus here.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily. I do actually agree with Constanze that Brin's a bit too full of himself in that aspect. But on the other hand, you have this exponential growth of means of surveillance and for gathering of data. And to a certain extent, I feel like the old farts in government trying to stop the internet from bringing social change, as in saying, well, you shouldn't gather this data, but at the same time, it's so cheap and easy and so insidious, put in every device. I mean, smart metering is the next step. Biometrics was mentioned. Nowadays, a fingerprint can be measured from more than a meter distance.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yes, and that distance will grow, given our experience with information technology. So basically, waving your hands in a surveyed square will result in your fingerprints being taken.
Yeah, well, so we were having this conversation yesterday about the fact that data retention, so, you know, one of our favorite things to try to destroy, is actually a secondary collection of data. It's not the first. So the only thing data retention does is kind of legitimizes the use of that data in the kind of legislative or judicial context. But the data has already been collected by GCHQ, NSA, you know, name any three or four letter agencies.
That is, no, in fact, that's not true for all the data. Of course, data retention would extend that.
Yeah, it does, but it further legitimizes the use of it, which is kind of the big thing, because GCHQ is not about to tell everybody that they used a particular set of data to find the criminals. They say, well, you know, we just know this somehow.
We're psychic.
Well, there's cheaper enough to
apply. Actually, we're in a good position here in Germany because of the ruling of the constitutional law, of course. You maybe know that.
Yeah, it's,
and actually, we are in the good position that, well, the government seems to not bring up a new law, and so we can wait for the European evaluation. And I just hope that in September, I think it's the 13th of September, I don't know exactly, we have that big demonstration here in Berlin again and in Brussels too, and we hope that many people are going on the street against that.
So on that note, and another announcement to make, this year there will be another Culture Forum in Barcelona. Look it up on fcforum.net. It will be very interesting, especially given the situation in Spain. And we're about to be thrown out of the studio by the guys who are going to do the graveyard shift. And in the spirit of the graveyard shift, I'll finish with Stalag Rhythm by King Dubby.